Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is David Livingstone, the celebrated explorer and anti-slavery campaigner. And of course, my co-host for today will be Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we move on to our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into our Greatest Britons for the week. Our Greatest Briton this week is David Livingstone. David Livingstone was born on the 19th of March 1813, and he died on the 1st of May 1873. He was a Scottish physician, a pioneer Christian missionary, an explorer in Africa, and one of the most popular British heroes of the late 19th century Victorian era. He had a mythic status that operated on a number of interconnected levels. Protestant missionary martyr, working class rags to riches inspirational story, scientific investigator, adventure explorer, imperial reformer, anti-slavery crusader, and advocate for British commercial and colonial expansion. Livingstone's fame as an explorer and his obsession with learning the sources of the Nile River was founded on the belief that if he could solve this age-old mystery, his fame would give him the influence he needed to end the East African Arab Swahili slave trade. "The Nile sources," he told a friend, "are valuable only as a means of opening my mouth with power among men. It is this power with which I hope to remedy an immense evil." His subsequent exploration of the Central African wilderness was the culmination of the classic period of European geographical discovery and the colonial penetration of Africa. At the same time, his missionary travels, his disappearance, and his eventual death in Africa and subsequent glorification as a posthumous national hero in 1874 led to the founding of several major Central African Christian missionary initiatives carried forwards into the era of the European scramble for Africa. And he led a really exciting life. And what they really miss out there is that this idea he had of opening up Africa, once he'd done this exploration work and he'd mapped the rivers, the idea was that we could have trade in Africa, and the trade which we would have in Africa would help the Africans to replace the slave trade. So this idea that we went into Africa and we oppressed them and we took them as slaves and we're selling them to America, it's the complete opposite of that. The reason why we went in there was so that they could stop selling other Africans as slaves. And David Livingstone was really against this. It was his life's mission was to stop slavery. And he tried various different ways of doing it. And also this exploratory work and trying to find the sources of the Nile. He went on quite a few different expeditions, and we'll hear about some of the things that that happened in them. And as far as the Christian missionary work is concerned, he actually only succeeded in converting one of the natives to becoming Christian, and yet he's known as this great missionary, and really he didn't really have that much success with that. He had much more success with his exploratory work and also inspiring the British people, because it really is a rags to riches story, this one. Max, what are your thoughts on David Livingstone?
Well, I've not really seen quite how David Livingstone's life as yet perhaps interconnects with the life of Cecil Rhodes. But what I would say is that certainly, you know, from what you've said so far, that the thrust of David Livingstone's work is very much in keeping with what Cecil Rhodes did. And Cecil Rhodes obviously worked from South Africa and was exploring his way north and attempting to create this railway line that would extend all the way from Cape Town through to Cairo, and in searching for the source of the River Nile, it would seem that David Livingstone was working from in the opposite direction, trying to create a connection between the north of Africa and the south of Africa, which would have been in keeping with, as I say, Cecil Rhodes' ambitions. But also it seems that in doing work as a missionary, and certainly in doing work to eliminate slavery in Africa, that David Livingstone was was working with many of the same goals as Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah, well, he paved the way for Cecil Rhodes, I think. If it hadn't been for the exploratory work that he did, Africa wouldn't have been opened up and Cecil Rhodes wouldn't have been able to go in there and modify things in the way that he did. Well, Livingstone was born on the 19th of March 1813 in the mill town of Blantyre, Scotland, in a tenement building for the workers of a cotton factory on the banks of the River Clyde. He was the second of seven children born to Neil Livingstone and his wife, Agnes. Neil Livingstone was a Sunday school teacher and a teetotaler who handed out Christian tracts on his travels as a door-to-door tea salesman, and he read books on theology, travel and missionary enterprises extensively. This rubbed off on the young David, who became an avid reader, but he also loved scouring the countryside for animal, plant and geological specimens in the local limestone quarries, sparking off an interest in the natural world. He was employed at the age of 10 in the cotton mill of Henry Monteith and Co. in Blantyre Works, where he and his brother John worked 12-hour days as piecers, tying broken cotton threads on the spinning machines, often while they were still in motion. Now, just think about that. You're 10 years old and you're working in a cotton mill. You're working a 12-hour day, and yet you're also spending time going around the countryside, learning about the natural world. You're also finding time to read. And when he was actually in the cotton mill, I mean, this is a dangerous job. These spinning machines are still in motion. This is at the time when we still had white children that were being sent up chimneys. We had white children that were working in these cotton mills. And at the same time as that, the British government were trying to stop slavery in America and stop black slavery, when we had these essentially white slaves that were working in Britain. And the reason for that is because they wanted to bring in the wage system, because it was actually cheaper to employ people and pay them wages than it was to maintain a slave with warmth and clothing and housing and food and medicine and all the rest of it. It was cheaper just to pay people an hourly wage or a daily wage than it actually was for slavery. And that was the real reason for them getting rid of slavery, which really destroys this notion that there was some oppression involved in slavery, or that the slaves weren't actually getting anything out of it. Because in actual fact, they must have been getting more out of it than the people that were on wages, because it was cheaper to do it the other way around. And I guess that David Livingstone wasn't aware of this. I mean, he just saw the way that these blacks were treated. He'd read about it. Don't forget, he hasn't actually gone to Africa yet. He's just read about this in Scotland, so he doesn't have any experience of it. So he's seen a lot of this this propaganda that is against slavery, alongside all the Christian teachings of his father. You got any thoughts on his early life here, Max?
Well, I think that his early life pretty much destroys the concept that we here in Britain enjoyed white privilege, and that it was as a result of the existence of the British Empire that we that all of our wealth was built on. Because David Livingstone, as you say, was working as a young boy in a very dangerous job, working 12 hours a day, and we often see these adverts on television for organisations that are charities in the third world, and they'll pick on an individual child and say about how, you know, little Mary has to walk 12 miles with a vase on her head so she can collect the water for the family, and therefore this is the reason for the poverty of her community and the reason for the poverty in Africa, and it's all the fault of us white people because we've not given them enough money. In reality, if you look at the lives of people like David Livingstone, you know, they were born with very little more, and one would argue nothing more than the very people that are being portrayed in Africa as the sufferers of poverty that's been imposed upon them. Well, the example of David Livingstone is that if you're prepared to work hard and seize opportunities, then you can rise literally from rags to riches. And that there is no excuse really for other parts of the world blaming Britain for their poverty.
you know, especially when you look at the textile industry, because we do see adverts and it will show you some poor non-white child working in the textile industry, and we've been told they're being paid peanuts. Well, this is exactly what the white children were doing 150 years ago. They were working in the textile industry, and it was a lot more dangerous back then than it is now. As we will hear, about his job now, what he actually did. This job, piecing, involved repairing the sporadic yarn breakages. At the rollers, the broken yarn would be caught on the underclearer, while at the spindle, it would knot itself into a whirl on the spindle tip. If the break happened on the winding stroke, the spindle might have to be stopped while the thread was found and rejoined. But normally, this would be attempted while the machine was still moving. So think about that. You've got industrial machinery here. It's moving up and down. It's moving very fast. And you've got a 10-year-old child that is diving underneath it, diving all around it, trying to get these bits of thread so that he can tie it together. And, you know, you just know that there must have been loads of broken arms and kids getting their arms caught up in the rollers. I mean, it was a real brutal industry, basically, when you think of it.
Losing fingers.
Yeah, losing fingers, you know, damaging your limbs. And unlike the slaves, you know, they didn't have paid for medical care if they were injured. This is one of the things that the slaves had that the ordinary employed didn't have.
Breathing air thick with cotton dust in a confined space for 12 hours a day. Just imagine what that did to their lungs.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, how did they manage to clean themselves? They probably weren't that clean either. And you think this is somebody in a family of seven, and his father is a preacher. So, I mean, you think about preachers today, they're middle class, aren't they? Vicars. So, I mean, this is what the middle class were like. This is what work was like. 12 years old, and you would have to be working in this dangerous job. The number of yarn breakages was dependent on the quality of the roving, and quality cotton led to fewer breakages. Typically, 1,200 spindle mills of the 1920s would experience 5 to 6 breakages a minute. 5 to 6 of these would happen a minute. So, I mean, you're going to need a lot of kids running around tying this up and you know, falling over themselves trying to get this done. The two pieces were needed to repair the thread within the 15 to 20 seconds that the mule was in motion. But once they actually had the thread, it took under 3 seconds, and the repair itself involved a slight rolling of the forefinger against the thumb. So this isn't just waiting around for a breakage that's going to happen, I don't know, once an hour or something like that. This is, you know, this is all the time, 5 to 6 breakages a minute. And they're literally just going to be on their feet all day for 12 hours a day. Livingstone's experiences in the cotton mill were from the ages of 10 to 26, first as a piecer and later as a spinner. This monotonous work was necessary for him to support his impoverished family, but it also taught him persistence, endurance, and a natural empathy with all who labour, as expressed by lines that he used to hum from the Rabbi Burns song, "When man to man the world o'er, shall brothers be for that." And I don't really understand what he's saying there, but I guess it's solidarity between the workers of the world. I guess he must have had a bit of a left-wing leaning. It does sound like it. Max, you got any thoughts on that? Any extra thoughts?
Well, I would agree with your interpretation of that line from Livingstone. But it's just good, really, that as far as the people who are campaigning for the destruction of statues of everybody great in Britain, that they've left Livingstone alone so far. And so hopefully the example that he set and the philosophy that he followed in his life can remain as part of our culture and can inspire future generations.
I bet it's only time until they go for David Livingstone, because of course he was white. Well, he attended Blantyre Village School along with a few other mill children with the endurance to do so, despite their 14-hour working day, which was 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. I mean, just when did they have the time to do this? I guess it must have been Sunday school, because they would have had time off for church. So school would have just been in the Sunday afternoon. Having a family with a strong ongoing commitment to study helped to reinforce his desire for education. After reading an appeal for medical missionaries to China in 1834, he began saving his money to enter Anderson's University, Glasgow, which he did in 1836, while also attending Greek and theology lectures at the University of Glasgow. To enter medical school, he required some knowledge of Latin and was tutored by a local Roman Catholic man, Daniel Gallagher. In addition to his other studies, he attended divinity lectures by Wardlaw, who was a leader at this time of vigorous anti-slavery campaigning in the city. Shortly after, he applied to join the London Missionary Society and was accepted, subject to completing missionary training, which he did while studying at the Charing Cross Hospital Medical School, with his courses covering medical practice, midwifery and botany. The missionary training was carried out in London and in Ongar, Essex, where he learned to be a minister within the Congregational Union, serving under the LMS. And I guess they were good things for him to learn if he's going out there to Africa, ostensibly to help these African tribal people, midwifery and medical practice, and at the same time botany, so that he can record the flora and the fauna that he finds there. And while training under the LMS, he and the other students were taught Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and theology by the Reverend Richard Cecil. Despite his impressive personality, Livingstone was a plain preacher, described by Cecil as worthy but remote from brilliant. And he would have been rejected by the LMS had the director not given him a second chance to pass the course. He eventually qualified as a licentiate of the Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons of Glasgow on the 16th of November 1840 and was later made an honorary fellow of the faculty on the 5th of January 1850. So, I mean, this is a really dedicated man to come from working in these cotton mills and then only being taught on a Sunday at his Sunday school, and then he goes on to university where he learns Greek, Latin, Hebrew and theology, and learns these practical courses as well, because he wants to be a missionary. He wants to do what he can for other people. You know, this is what we're like as white people. We're very charitable people, and a lot of us wish to dedicate our lives to helping others, whether it's in the medical industry or whether it's through being a missionary, whether it's even through people joining the army and wishing to lay down their lives for others. It's all about this desire to do things for the group. And that is an ethnic, it's an ethnic instinct of wanting to do what you can for your family and wanting to do what you can for your extended family. But this is being extended beyond that. And he's wanting to do what he can for the other families of the world, which is really a credit to white people. And for us to then be called racist when, you know, we have large groupings of our people that just dedicate their lives to doing things for other peoples, whether that's right or wrong, you have to say, well, this shows that white people are incredibly generous and incredibly charitable. And David Livingstone was a good example of this. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Just to agree with you, but also to say that all this studying that Livingstone did was also presumably during the period that he would have been working in order to provide for himself at the same time.
Yes, he would have had to work and fund this as well, and he was also paying for his family. It's hard work, and what was this, 170 years ago, basically. Livingstone had hoped to go to China as a missionary, but the first Opium War broke out in September 1840 while he was continuing his medical studies in London. When he met LMS missionary Robert Moffat on leave from Kuruman, a missionary outpost in South Africa, north of the Orange River, he was excited by Moffat's vision of expanding missionary work northwards. And this, combined with an influence from the abolitionist T.F. Buxton's arguments that the African slave trade might be destroyed through the influence of legitimate trade and the spread of Christianity, led to Livingstone focusing his ambitions on southern Africa instead. So two reasons there why he went to Africa, because there were these problems in China, and also because he's starting to get this feel of wanting to put a stop to slavery. And you can see this idea of legitimate trade, a large part of the reasoning for setting up this trade was to help do away with slavery. It wasn't to rip the Africans off or oppress them in any way. Well, Livingstone is deeply influenced by his missionary friend Moffat's judgment. that he was the right person to go to the vast plains north of Bechuanaland, where he had glimpsed the smoke of a thousand villages where no missionary had ever been. During this time, he visited Mabotsa, Botswana, an area where there were many lions terrorizing the villagers. They stated, "The lion, the lord of the night, kills our cattle and sheep, even in the daytime." And Livingstone felt that if he could kill just one lion, the others would take it as a warning and leave the villages and their livestock alone. Therefore, he led the villagers on a lion hunt, and seeing a large lion, he fired his gun. But the animal was not injured enough to prevent it from attacking him while he was reloading, and he seriously wounded his left arm. The broken bone, even though set by himself with the help of a missionary's daughter, bonded strongly, and he was still able to shoot and lift weights, but it remained a source of much suffering for the rest of his life, and he was not able to lift his arm any higher than his shoulder. So this tells us what it was like for the for these Africans. You know, they did live in fear of lions, much the same as we would have lived in fear of wolves, I guess, some years ago. Do you want to add anything there, Max?
I think that he showed his lack of experience as a hunter by not having somebody else stood by the side of him with a loaded gun whilst he reloaded. But certainly being attacked by a lion is the sort of thing that would end in death for most people, and so he was lucky to escape with his life.
Yeah, he's taken a lot of risks there. That's a good point there, but I wonder if he could have trusted any of these Africans with one of these guns. And I guess he had other missionaries there, because he had the missionary's daughter that was helping him. So, yeah, he really wasn't thinking ahead there. Obviously not used to hunting. Well, Livingstone was obliged to leave his first mission at Mabotsa in 1845 after irreconcilable differences emerged between him and his fellow missionary, Roger Edwards, and because the Bagatla were proving indifferent to the gospel. He abandoned his next mission too, in Chonawane, because of drought, the close proximity of the Boers, and his desire to move on to the regions beyond. Finally, at the Kolobeng mission in 1849, Livingstone converted his first and only African chief, Sechelle, after 2 years of patient persuasion. Livingstone is known as Africa's greatest missionary, yet he is recorded as having converted only one African, Sechelle, who was the chief of the Kwena people of Botswana. Sechelle was born in 1812, and his father died when Sechelle was just 10, and two of his uncles divided the tribe between themselves, forcing Sechelle to leave his home for 9 years. When he returned, he took over one of his uncle's tribes, and at that point he met Livingstone, who was known throughout a large part of Africa for treating the natives with respect, and that respect being responded to with faith and loyalty. He could never permanently convert the tribesmen to Christianity, however. Among other reasons, Sechelle, by then the leader of the African tribe, did not like the way that Livingstone did not demand rain of his god like his rainmakers did, who boasted that they could. After long hesitation from Livingstone, he finally baptized Sechelle and encouraged the church to completely embrace him. But Sechelle, who is now a part of the church, continued to act according to his African culture, which went against Livingstone's teachings. Being no different from any other man in his tribe, he believed in polygamy, and he had 5 wives. So when Livingstone told him to get rid of 4 of them, it shook the Kwena tribe to its foundations. After finally divorcing the 4 women, Livingstone baptized them all and everything went well. However, 1 year later, one of his ex-wives became pregnant, and Sechelle was the father. He begged Livingstone not to give up on him because his faith was still strong, but Livingstone left the country and went north to continue his Christianizing attempts. After Livingstone had left the Kwena tribe, we are told that Sechelle remained faithful to Christianity, and he led missionaries to other surrounding tribes as well, converting nearly his entire Kwena people. In the estimation of Neil Parsons of the University of Botswana, Sechelle did more to propagate Christianity in 19th century southern Africa than virtually any single European missionary did. Although Sechelle saw himself as a Christian, many European missionaries disagreed, as the Kwena tribe leader kept rainmaking as a part of his life, as well as polygamy. Well, what this shows is that Livingstone must have made a very, very big impression on this tribal chief, this Sechelle, and he must have done, because he tried to convert his people. But at the same time, it shows us that they have their ethnic drives and they have their traditions, and they're not going to give up those traditions. They're not going to give up the traditions of polygamy, because that's the way that they live. They have many wives, they have many children, they have a very, very fast life history strategy. They don't invest lots of time in these children because life is very cheap there, as we see with the lion. People are going to be dying a lot. I should imagine a lot of his children died. And if he was just to limit himself to one wife, he may end up with all of his children dying. You need to have many wives, you need to have many children, so that he can be looked after in his old age. A completely different way of living to the way that we live in the West, where we invest a lot of time in producing our children and in educating them, and we don't have that many of them because we have a completely different way of doing things. So you can see that the Christian religion did not fit very well with the actual way of living of these Africans. You got any comments on that, Max?
I think your interpretation there is quite true, actually. I think it was perhaps a little bit naive of Livingstone to expect the complete conversion of African tribes in one fell swoop, and that it's pretty obvious, really, from his experience there, that it would take a lot of waves of Christianizing, wave upon wave, in order to eventually instill Christianity along the European model. And it was only to be expected that Christianity would have to bend to some extent to accept African culture if it was to become acceptable to the people of Africa.
You know, I do find it ironic that today it's really only the African church that is sticking to the traditional Christian morality. It's only the African church that still makes homosexuality illegal and makes divorce illegal and all these traditional Christian things that they were taught 150 years ago. And now they look over here at the West and they see the West having transsexual coronations in the churches and allowing gay weddings, and they're absolutely mystified and scandalized by this. And you know, it's the African church is really shaming the European churches at the moment by actually sticking to these Christian traditions. I just find that very ironic. Well, we should probably leave that there, Max, unless you've got anything else that you'd like to add.
I was just going to agree with you, actually, that it was extremely ironic that the African tribes have stuck to the traditional Christianity and are mystified by the way that the church purports itself over here in Europe.
And also, the churches back then, they didn't want to accept Cecil. That, you know, they said, well, he's not really a proper Christian. He still has these extra wives, and yet they ended up being the ones sticking to the law rather than us.
Yeah, it's a strange old world we live in, isn't it?
We'll start with a recap. David Livingstone was one of the most popular British heroes of the late 19th century Victorian era, and his exploration of the Central African wilderness marked the final culmination of the European discovery period. His early life was hard, and we saw him working in the cotton mills from the age of 10 for 14 hours a day, while spending his Sundays getting an education before becoming a missionary and heading for Africa. His first attempt at impressing the natives by killing a lion that had been bothering them went horribly wrong when he failed to kill it with one shot, leading to permanent damage to his arm when the animal mauled it. He did succeed in converting one African, though, who went on to convert nearly his whole tribe, and we pointed out how today it is only these African churches who continue to observe traditional Christian morality. I think you pointed out, Max, that when he shot this lion, he should have had somebody else there to also fire at the lion while he was reloading. So
yes,
it showed that he really wasn't too well trained on these sort of things. Is there anything else that you want to pick up on in that?
Well, I think just really that we pretty well agreed last week and in the early weeks where we discussed David Livingstone, that he was somebody who goes against the normal for what is viewed as being somebody of the empire. He he hadn't gone out into the British Empire in order to enrich himself or to seek glory. He'd gone out into the empire in order to help uplift the peoples that were subjects of the empire. And the fact that he was trying to spread Christianity was an aspect of that.
Oh, and he was totally against slavery as well. And he'd worked his way up to this from a very poor beginnings. You imagine, he's working 14 hours a day at the age of 10 in very dangerous conditions, darting in and out of these machines that are part of the textile industry, and spending his Sundays educating himself. And he just wanted to dedicate himself to helping the lives of Africans, really. I mean, the people back here in Britain, the politicians, they really should have been dedicating themselves to helping the lives of people like David Livingstone, having to work in these textile factories and in these workhouses. But they were more concerned with stopping slavery over the other side of the world. And this is also what David Livingstone was wanting to do, because he saw some really horrific things as part of the slave trade, that particularly that were being carried out by the Arabs. And we often don't draw a distinction between these Arab slave traders and also the white slave traders, but the Arab slave traders were far more brutal than the white traders that would pick up their slaves from the blacks and from the Africans. Well, getting back to the story here, in 1851, when Livingstone left the Kolobeng mission, and that was the mission where he had converted this one African to Christianity, he did not use his failure with Seychelles to explain his departure, although it surely played an important role in his decision. Just as important had been the three journeys far to the north of Kolobeng that he had undertaken between 1849 and 1851, and which left him convinced that the best long-term chance for successfully evangelizing was to explore Africa in advance of European commercial interests and other missionaries, by mapping it and navigating its rivers, which would then become highways into the interior. Livingstone departed from the village of Linyanti, located right in the centre of the continent on the Zambezi River. He had reached this point coming from the south in Cape Town, and it was the Northern Frontier Missionary Post. He believed that if he set out from Linyanti to the northwest, up the Zambezi, this would map the best highway into the Dark Continent. He had the help of 27 native guides and warriors loaned to him by Sekulutu, the chief of the Kololo in Linyanti. They eventually reached the Portuguese city of Luanda on the Atlantic coast after profound difficulties and the near death of Livingstone from fever. He realised the route would be too difficult for future traders, so he retraced his journey back to Linyanti, and with 114 men this time, loaned by the same chief, he set off east down the Zambezi. On this leg, he became the first European to see the Smoke That Thunders waterfall, which he named Victoria Falls after Queen Victoria. Eventually, he successfully reached Quelimane on the Indian Ocean, having mapped most of the course of the Zambezi River. In this way, Livingstone became the first European to cross South Central Africa, which had never been crossed by Europeans at that latitude before, and his accomplishment made him world famous, and Livingstone was hailed as the explorer who had opened up Africa. So there's two things that we see there. We see that he has this idea that first we have to make our way into Africa and we have to open up a highway, and then we can bring Christianity to them. And he also was thinking, and then also we can open up trade to them, and trade will replace slavery, and we'll get them to start making things instead of selling each other as slaves. And secondly, we see that he had this terrible fever while he was doing this. He was very, very ill from where he had injured his arm. I mean, most of the time when he was actually in Africa, he had a fever, he had all these illnesses. If you think about the mosquitoes there and the fever that they get from that, and the Africans themselves, they're pretty much immune to it. That's why they made such good slaves in South America, because they were immune to all these fevers and diseases that you get in Africa. But as a white man, you're very susceptible to them. And this didn't stop him. He was convinced that he was going to carry on. He was going to keep going, and he was going to map this route, which had never been mapped before by anybody. And it was really this route that he mapped on his way into Central Africa that opened up the whole of Africa for everybody else to get there and start colonizing and to help to get rid of the slave trade, basically. You got any comments on that, Max?
Just also to say that during the course of this exploration of Africa, there were also great migrations taking place amongst the native African people, and so there was a migration from Western and Central Africa eastwards towards the Indian Ocean, but then also southwards, and this is the migration that took place by the Zulus and other Bantu tribes, and they were moving into territory that had previously only been occupied by the San, who are the people that are often referred to as Kalahari Bushmen, and so the San were effectively retreating in the face of the advancing Zulus and other Bantu tribes, and so Africa was a place of shifting and a place of change in those times, and the activities of people such as Livingstone and the other Great Britons that we've spoken about in the past, who have in their explorations and colonizations of parts of Africa, they were all part and parcel of that great period of turmoil and change.
I think we should also point out that even though he was against slavery and he was wanting to do his best for these Africans, he knew that there was a difference between the races. I mean, he had 100 servants here with him while he was doing this, and he needed to have their help, but it was still seen as he was the first European to do this, to map this route. And you know, you think, well, why didn't the Africans do this? Why didn't they build their own highways? They weren't capable of doing that. They needed Livingstone there to do all of this for them and to direct this for them, to try and bring them out of essentially the Stone Age, which is what they were living in. And he wanted to bring them out from that and bring them the gifts of civilization. Well, Livingstone advocated the establishment of trade and religious missions in Central Africa, but it was the abolition of the African slave trade, as carried out by the Portuguese of Tete and the Arab Swahili of Kilwa, that became his primary goal. His motto, now inscribed on his statue at Victoria Falls, was Christianity, Commerce and Civilization, a combination that he hoped would form an alternative to the slave trade and impart dignity to the Africans. He believed that the key to achieving these goals would be the navigation of the Zambezi River as a Christian commercial highway into the interior, and he returned to Britain to garner support for his ideas and to publish a book on his travels, which brought him well-deserved fame as one of the leading explorers of the age. He believed his spiritual calling was for exploration, to find routes for commercial trade, which would displace the slave trade, rather than for preaching, and he was encouraged by the response in Britain to his discoveries and the support he garnered for future expeditions. So he resigned from the London Missionary Society in 1857. According to his Victorian biographer, W. Garden Blakey, the reason given was to prevent public concern about his non-missionary activities, such as the scientific work, which might have shown the LMS to be departing from the proper objects of a missionary body. In May 1857, Livingstone was appointed as Her Majesty's Consul with a roving commission, extending through Mozambique to the areas west of it, and in February 1858, his area of jurisdiction was stipulated to be the eastern coast of Africa and the independent districts in the interior. And I think this is interesting, because today they will try and say that this building up of commerce, this was taking advantage of the Africans, this was oppressing the Africans, getting them to create things, getting them to work in mines. But the whole point of it was to try and get them to do something that would replace the slave trade. We didn't want them just selling themselves as slaves and being abused by the Arabs. And the way to prevent that was to bring commerce there and to open the place up and get them to get them to start working together. And I mean, it is unfortunate that today it has led to this massive explosion in demographics, where half of Africa now, I think, is under the age of 30. It may even be under the age of 20, which has been the unfortunate outcome of this. But the motives behind it were extremely charitable. It was trying to improve these people's lives. And he didn't want that to come in, the trade side of it, to get mixed up with the missionary side of it. So he ended up resigning from the mission. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, I agree with the points that you've made there. It is unfortunate that by taking industry and civilization and medicine in particular to parts of the third world, that that has now led to the great population increases in the world that have taken place, and that increase in world population is one of the main factors in creating conflict in the world today, and so it's strange that on the one hand we have the green and the ecology movements suggesting that we shouldn't disturb the natural balance of nature in the places that we go to with regard to animal life, and perhaps there is an argument for not disturbing the natural balance that exists between the human inhabitants of areas that that we come into contact with in the same way.
It's like the road to hell is paved with good intentions, especially if the good intentions are directed towards the outgroup instead of directed towards the in-group. The British government agreed to fund Livingstone's idea, and he returned to Africa as head of the second Zambezi expedition to examine the natural resources of southeastern Africa and to open up the Zambezi River. However, it turned out to be completely impassable to boats past the Kahura Bassa Rapids, a series of cataracts and rapids that Livingstone had failed to explore on his earlier travels. The expedition lasted 6 years, from March 1858 until the middle of 1864. Expedition members recorded that Livingstone was an inept leader, incapable of managing a large-scale project. He was also said to be secretive, self-righteous, and moody, and could not tolerate criticism, all of which severely strained the expedition and which led to his physician John Kirk writing in 1862, "I can come to no other conclusion than that Dr. Livingstone is out of his mind and a most unsafe leader." Artist Thomas Baines was dismissed from the expedition on charges of theft, which he vigorously denied. The expedition became the first to reach Lake Malawi, and they explored it in a four-oared gig. In 1862, they returned to the coast to await the arrival of a steamboat specially designed to sail on Lake Malawi, and Mary Livingstone arrived along with the boat, having been determined to join him. But she died on the 27th of April 1862 from malaria, and Livingstone continued his explorations without her. So he may not have been that good a leader, but his determination was second to none. I mean, he would just continue with the mission that he had. He was going to achieve what he had set out to achieve, no matter what happened, even if his wife ends up dying. And we can also see there the reason why these great men from the British Empire, why they would leave their wives at home, or why they would not get married in the first place, because it was very dangerous to have a wife with you. As we see here, she just ended up catching malaria and dying. Do you want to add any comments there, Max?
And it could well be that the criticisms levelled against him with regard to his leadership ability were more a reflection of the fact that he was ill most of the time, rather than he had a natural lack of ability in that respect.
And it could also be that the people that are writing about him today are also trying to find negatives, the culture of critique. Well, the attempts to navigate the Rovuma River failed because of the continual fouling of the paddle wheels from the bodies that had been thrown into the river by the Arab Swahili slave traders. And Livingstone's assistants gradually all died or left him. It was at this point that he uttered his most famous quotation, "I am prepared to go anywhere, provided it be forward." but the British government recalled the expedition in 1863 when it was clear that Livingstone's optimism about economic and political developments in the Zambezi regions were premature. Livingstone, however, showed something of his old fire when he took his little vessel, the Lady Nyassa, with a small untrained crew and little fuel on a hazardous voyage of 2,500 miles across the Indian Ocean and left it for sale in Bombay, now Mumbai. Furthermore, within the next three decades, the Zambezi expedition proved to be anything but a disaster. It had amassed a valuable body of scientific knowledge, and the John Kirk, Charles Miller and Richard Thornton, the scientists appointed to work under Livingstone, did contribute large collections of botanical, ecological, geological and ethnographic material to scientific institutions in the United Kingdom from the trip. The association of the Lake Nyassa regions with Livingstone's name and the prospects for colonisation that he envisaged there were important factors for the creation in 1893 of the British Central Africa Protectorate, which in 1907 became Nyasaland, and in 1966 the Republic of Malawi. So his discovery and his setting this place up actually led to an African country, the African country of Malawi. And we can see here the sort of conditions that he's in when the river itself, the paddle wheels won't work because the river is filled up with too many bodies that have been thrown into it by Arab Swahili slave traders. So what we have there is we have Arabian Negro slave traders, basically. Swahili is a black African language. Arab is an ethnicity. So, I mean, what we're talking about there is Arabs and blacks. That's not white slave traders that have been doing this. So we'll hear a little bit more about how vile this trade actually was in a bit. Do you want to add anything to this, Max?
It's sort of evident, really, in terms of the setting the scene for the creation of Nyasaland and Malawi, that Livingstone achieved much of the same things that Cecil Rhodes did in terms of creating new countries and new administrations for parts of Africa, but did it in a rather different way.
And this happened after some years after Livingstone had died, but he was the one that really sowed the seeds for the country of Malawi. In January 1866, Livingstone returned to Africa, this time to Zanzibar, to seek out the source of the Nile. Richard Francis Burton, John Hanning Speke and Samuel Baker had identified either Lake Albert or Lake Victoria as the source, which was partially correct, as the Nile bubbles from the ground high in the mountains of Burundi, halfway between Lake Tanganyika and Lake Victoria. But there was still serious debate on the matter. Livingstone believed that the source was further south, and assembled a team to find it, consisting of freed slaves, Comoros islanders, 12 sepoys and two servants from his previous expedition, Chuma and Susi. He set out from the mouth of the Rovuma River, but his assistants gradually began deserting him, with the Comoros islanders returning to Zanzibar and falsely informing the authorities that Livingstone had died. He reached Lake Malawi on the 6th of August, by which time most of his supplies had been stolen, including all his medicines. He then travelled through swamps in the direction of Lake Tanganyika, with his health declining. He sent a message to Zanzibar requesting that supplies be sent to Ujiji before heading west, before being forced by ill health to travel with passing slave traders. He arrived at Lake Muweru on the 8th of November 1867 and continued on, travelling south to become the first European to seek Lake Bangweulu. Upon finding the Lualaba River, Livingstone theorised that it could have been the high part of the Nile River, but realised that it in fact flowed into the River Congo at the upper Congo Lake. The year 1869 began with Livingstone finding himself extremely ill while in the jungle, but luckily he was saved by Arab slave traders who gave him medicines and carried him to an Arab outpost. In March 1869, he arrived in Ujiji, suffering from pneumonia, only to find his supplies had been stolen. He was coming down with cholera and had tropical ulcers on his feet, so he was again forced to rely on the slave traders to get him as far as Bambara, where he was then caught by the wet season. With no supplies, Livingstone ended up having to eat his meals in a roped-off enclosure for the entertainment of the natives, in return for them feeding him. I mean, the poor guy's in a really bad situation here. These people he's trying to help, they've all ripped him off. They've all stolen from him. They've run away. They've told the authorities where they ran away to that he's actually died. So there's no point in sending any more supplies. And he's now forced to rely on these slave traders to keep him alive. And he ends up eating in a roped off enclosure while the natives are laughing at him. And he's really got himself into a bad way here.
Yes, falling into the hands of his enemies, effectively, hasn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, and I mean, I guess we have to give them credit as well that they looked after him. I mean, they must have seen, well, this is a white man, you have to look after him. You have to do what you can for him. This is an important person. I guess that's the way that the Arabs saw it, even though he was sort of opposed to them in wanting to do away with the slave trade. Well, next we come to a rather famous massacre. On the 15th of July, 1871, Livingstone stated in his diary that he witnessed around 400 Africans being massacred by men of the Arab ruler and slave trader Dugumbi, an associate of his, while he was visiting Niangui on the banks of the Lualaba River. The cause behind this attack is stated to be retaliation for the actions of Manila, the head slave who had sacked the villages of the Mahombo people at the instigation of the Wagenya chieftain Kimburu. He has been credited with ending the East African slave trade by reporting on this massacre of slaves in 1871. The 400 slaves that were killed were part of 1,500 that were assembled at a market, and Livingstone's diary makes it clear how much he wanted to avenge this bloodthirsty injustice. The massacre horrified Livingstone, leaving him too shattered to continue his mission to find the source of the Nile. And following the end of the wet season, he travelled 240 miles from Ngamwe back to Ujiji, an Arab settlement on the eastern shore of Lake Tanganyika, being violently ill most of the way and arriving on the 23rd of October, 1871. So we see here that the guy that actually carried out this massacre was an associate of his. It was somebody he was having to rely upon, and it was retribution for, or retaliation for, other actions that had gone on. And these were very brutal people. The slaves themselves would think nothing of killing other slaves. The chiefs would think nothing of killing them. And this is why the white slave traders saw that what they were doing was actually beneficial to these Africans, to go to somewhere like America and be looked after by white slave masters was far preferable to being looked after by African chiefs or being looked after by Arab slave traders who would just massacre them in retribution. And you certainly wouldn't get that in America. They had laws that had to be obeyed, but there were no laws here. And it was this massacre and the reporting on it and saying to people, look, this is what is going on between the Arabs and the blacks in Africa, that actually inadvertently led to the banning of it, and also to Britain enforcing this ban, because the Africans really did not want to stop slavery. They didn't want to stop it at all. This is a real bugbear of mine. You know, they say Britain was responsible for slavery, yet all Africa had to do was make it illegal, and there would have been no slavery. It was Africa that was centre of the slave trade, not Britain. Do you want to add any comments to this, Max?
Well, just I quite often refer to a television programme that was shown, must be more than 20 years ago now, but from my recollection, it was called The Tribe, and it was a series of programmes produced by a chap who was an anthropologist now, but who had been, I think he'd been a Royal Marine in his earlier life. And he used to go to indigenous peoples in remote parts of the world, and he would live with them for 6 months or so, long enough to learn all about their customs, etc. But also he made a habit of going through the manhood ceremony for each one of these tribes. And I can remember him, there was one of the programs that he had where he was living with a tribe of people in a very remote part of Central Africa. And so this is, you know, only going back to something like the late 1990s, and was talking to a chap there. And the tribe he was with had lived in a particular valley since time immemorial, and since time immemorial they had raised cattle, and they, the cattle that they had were the source of their wealth. But they had rival tribes that lived in the surrounding valleys. And I don't know how this question came about, but at one point the anthropologist who was presenting the program asked this young chap who was representative of his tribe what the best day of his life had been. And this chap said it was the day that they got their first supply of AK-47 rifles, because they were then able to go over the pass into the next valley and massacre all of their rivals and steal all their cattle. And he sort of recounted this with a great amount of glee on his face. And I think that pretty much is in line with the kind of violence that you've just been recounting, where there is even to this very day a great amount of savagery that takes place on the continent of Africa.
It was going on back then. It was going on today. Yeah, I remember that series. A fascinating series. Yeah, I think it was just called Tribe. Well, Livingstone completely lost contact with the outside world for 6 years during this expedition. And remember that the authorities have been told that he was dead as well by his servants, unfortunately. And he was ill for most of the last 4 years of his life. Only one of his 44 letter dispatches made it to Zanzibar. One surviving letter to Horace Waller that was made available to the public in 2010 by its owner, Peter Beard, reads, "I am terribly knocked up, but this is for your eyes only. I am doubtful if I will live to see you again." Henry Morton Stanley had been sent to find him by the New York Herald newspaper in 1869, and he found Livingstone in the town of Ujiji on the shores of Lake Tanganyika on 10th of November 1871, and he greeted him with the now famous words, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." Livingstone responded, "Yes," and then, "I feel thankful that I am here to welcome you." These famous words may have been a fabrication, as Stanley later tore out the pages of this encounter in his diary. Even Livingstone's account of this encounter does not mention these words. However, the phrase appears in a New York Herald editorial dated 10th of August 1872, and the Encyclopaedia Britannica and the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography both quote it without questioning its veracity. The words are famous because of their perceived humour. Livingstone, being the only other white person for hundreds of miles, along with Stanley's clumsy attempt at appearing dignified in the bush of Africa by making a formal greeting one might expect to hear in the confines of an upper-class London club. However, readers of the Herald immediately saw through Stanley's pretensions. As noted by his biographer Tim Geale, Stanley struggled his whole life with a self-perceived weakness of being from a humble background and manufactured events to make up for this supposed deficiency. Stanley's book suggests that this greeting was truly motivated by embarrassment because he did not dare to embrace Livingstone. News of the slave massacre emerged in the world's press after Livingstone recounted the events to the journalist after this famous meeting, and Stanley's reports of the massacre changed history, prompting the British government to close the East African slave trade, which sealed Livingstone's place in history as the catalyst for abolition. Despite Stanley's urgings, Livingstone was determined not to leave Africa until his mission was complete. But his illness made him confused, and he was having judgment difficulties at this late point in his life. He explored the Lualaba and, failing to find connections to the Nile, returned to Lake Bangweulu and its swamps to explore possible rivers flowing out northwards. So you can just imagine that, can't you? Him finally meeting him, he's been looking for him all this time, and he's in such a terrible way. And he remembers his decorum and talks to him in English. It must have been like amazing for him to hear somebody speaking in English and actually seeing somebody white after all this time and being in such a state, and everybody thinking that he was dead. Do you want to comment on that? Do you know about this Henry Morton Stanley?
I don't know any more of the story really than you've already recounted. It's interesting that there was this great searching for the source of the River Nile. I think the source of the River Nile is actually Lake Victoria, and there's a place called, I think it's called Jinja, J I NJA, which is very close to Kampala in Uganda, and it's that's where the water starts to drain off from the Lake Victoria and runs and is the source of the White Nile.
Yeah, that Dr. Livingstone, I presume. I think it's the most one of the most famous phrases that yes. there is. And this story really captured the imagination of the British. This white explorer who had been lost. Was he still alive? Was he not alive? What sort of a state was he in? And he was still on his mission. He was still trying to find the source of the Nile completely on his own, without any servants. I mean, we've talked about these expeditions that went out to the South Pole and in the freezing cold, and nobody knew whether they were alive or not. And what you've got here is the other end of the situation, where it's boiling hot, it's tropical, and again, nobody knows whether they're alive or not. And only Livingstone was completely on his own. He didn't have white men around him. He didn't even have any servants around him, and he was just being treated for the amusement of the natives. And don't forget, the reason why he was there was to improve the lives of these natives, these people that had mistreated him so badly. Well, let's get into David Livingstone then. We'll start with a recap from last week. We saw Livingstone resign from the Missionary Society after converting just one African, as he saw his calling being in exploring and opening up Africa to trade in the hopes of replacing the slave trade with other products. We heard about his travels up the Zambezi River, which brought back many new botanical discoveries, and we heard how he was the first to cross South Central Africa. His wife tried to join him, but she died, leaving him to press on, despite the bodies of discarded slaves fouling up the wheels of his paddle ship. His final mission was to find the source of the Nile, where he was abandoned by his servants and lost contact with the outside world for 6 years, before finally coming across Henry Morton Stanley, who greeted him with the famous greeting, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." Stanley brought back news of a horrific slave massacre that gave the final impetus needed for the anti-slavery movement to succeed and get Britain to enforce a ban on the trade in Africa. And I just had some thoughts here. I mean, where he was on his own in Africa for 6 years, you imagine that, being the only white man in Africa or in that area, and yet he was completely safe. And that shows that the white man was not looked upon as an oppressor. He was not looked upon as being a bad person at all by anyone. And this is at the height of the slave trade, when we're told that all these poor black Africans were being kidnapped by white people and taken to America. And yet you've got this white man on his own in deepest, darkest Africa. And he's not abused in any way. I mean, they did poke fun at him a bit. They put him in a corner and made him eat his food so that they could have a bit of a laugh at him. But he wasn't harmed in any way whatsoever. And I just wanted to point out that this shows that the white man, particularly the British, were respected and were seen as good people. And by the time Stanley actually got in touch with him, Livingstone was in a really bad way by this time, but he refused to actually come back to Britain with Stanley, and he resolved to continue in his search for the source of the Nile. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Just to say, really, that it was remarkable that somebody like Stanley was exploring Africa, and on the one hand was searching for the source of the River Nile, which seems to be like quite a sort of academic thing for somebody to want to do, whilst at the same time having as their mission the desire to open up Africa to commerce and civilization, and I think that it gets forgotten nowadays by people who have malign intentions towards white people, that there were lots of white people, even those that went out into Africa and into the third world and who were a party to the creation of the British Empire, that there were people amongst them who were motivated by the best of intentions, not only as far as the British Empire was concerned, but also the best of intentions as far as the native peoples that they came across during their explorations.
It was really only the colonising of Africa that did away with slavery. And actually, on the memorial to him, it says Christianity, commerce, civilization. And he saw all those three things as being linked in together. And those three things together would help to put a stop to the slave trade. Well, Livingstone was wrong about the Nile, but he identified numerous geographical features for Western science, such as Lake Ngami, Lake Malawi, and Lake Bangweulu, in addition to Victoria Falls. He filled in the details of Lake Tanganyika, Lake Maweru, and the course of many rivers, especially the Upper Zambezi, and his observations enabled large regions to be mapped, which previously had just been blank. Even so, the furthest north he reached was the north end of Lake Tanganyika, which was still south of the equator, and he did not penetrate the rainforest of the River Congo any further downstream than Negatangwe near Masisi. Now, if he'd tried to get into the rainforest, I think he would have died a lot sooner, because he would have had malaria, he had terrible hemorrhoids, he had dysentery. Don't forget, his arm was damaged by being mauled by a lion. I mean, he was physically in a very bad way by this time, but he refused to go back with Stanley. And he saw his mission to abolish slavery as being more important than anything else, more important than finding the source of the Nile, really. And he stated in a letter to the New York Herald, "And if my disclosures regarding the terrible Ugijian slavery should lead to the suppression of the East Coast slave trade, I shall regard that as a greater matter by far than the discovery of all the Nile sources together." And that was written in a letter to the editor of the New York Herald. So he saw his mission as trying to get rid of slavery as just more important than anything else. And he really did succeed in that. It was after the reports of the horrible massacre that we heard about last week. It was after that actually became known in the Western world that they put a stop to it. And what they meant by putting a stop to it was putting a stop to it in Africa, putting a stop to the Africans and the Arabs actually selling these poor folk. While talking about the slave trade in East Africa, he wrote in his journals, "To overdraw its evil is a simple impossibility." He also wrote about a group of slaves forced to march by Arab slave traders in the African Great Lakes region when he was travelling there in 1866. He said, "We passed a slave woman shot or stabbed through the body and lying on the path. A group of men stood about 100 yards off on one side and another of the women on the other side looking on. They said an Arab who passed early that morning had done it in anger at losing the price he had given for her because she was unable to walk any longer. 27th of June, 1866. Today we came across a man dead from starvation as he was very thin. One of our men wandered and found many slaves with slave sticks on, abandoned by their masters from want of food. They were too weak to be able to speak or say where they had come from, and some were quite young." He also described, "The strangest disease I have seen in this country seems really to be broken-heartedness, and it attacks free men who have been captured and made slaves. 21 were unchained, as now safe. However, all ran away at once, but 8, with many others still in chains, died in 3 days after the crossing. They described their only pain in the heart and placed the hand correctly on the spot, although many think the organ stands high up in the breastbone." So you can see he had a good understanding of this, and he was really, really wanted to do away with it and thought it was a terrible trade. And his books and his journals did stir up public support for the abolition of slavery. However, he became dependent for assistance on the very slave traders that he wished to put out of business. He was a poor leader of his peers, and we learned that last week, and he ended up on his last expedition as an individualist explorer, with servants and porters, but no expert support around him. At the same time, he did not use the methods of discipline that maverick explorers such as Stanley did to keep his retinue of porters in line and his supplies secure, which could have been the reason why his porters stole them and ran away. For these reasons, he accepted help and hospitality from 1867 onwards from Mohammed Bougarib and Mohammed bin Salah, who is also known as Mupamarari, traders who kept and traded in slaves, as he recounts in his journals. They, in turn, benefited from Livingstone's influence with local people, which facilitated Mpamarari's release from bondage to Mowata Kazembe. Livingstone was reportedly furious to discover that some of the replacement porters that were sent at his request from Ujiji were actually slaves. So we see it's not as cut and dried as Livingstone would want it to be. He is against slavery, but if he doesn't have slavery and he just has servants, the servants run away, they steal all his food, they steal all his medicines, and they disappear and they leave him on his own. Whereas Stanley actually did have slaves, and it was only thanks to him having those slaves that he was able to find Livingstone, and he kept discipline. He disciplined them, whereas Livingstone didn't. And also, this was the economy that they had in Africa. How else were they? The way they looked at it was, how else are we going to survive if we can't sell slaves? There isn't anything else that we can produce. And this is why he wanted to open the continent up to trade and get them producing other things that would then gradually replace the need for them to sell slaves. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just as far as the African slaves are concerned, a lot of these slaves would have been taken from various tribes by other rival tribes. And as we've discussed in the past, prior to the colonization of Africa, the whole continent was covered with tribes, many of whom competed with other tribes and didn't just compete, but were effectively in a constant state of war with the surrounding tribes. Where they would massacre those other tribes, and where they would take them as slaves if they could, and sell them on. And so, as far as the servants that that Livingstone would have had are concerned, those servants, many of them would have not been steeped in a culture of Christianity, commerce, and civilization. They wouldn't have really appreciated what Livingstone was trying to do, because as far as their early life was concerned, as far as the history of their tribe was concerned, they were in a constant state of war with other rival tribes around them, and so therefore, at the first opportunity, those people, you know, probably would have run away in many cases, And that the only way of stopping them from running away would have been to have employed the same tactics that the Arab slave traders would have used in disciplining and treating the servants like slaves. And so to a certain extent, it was a there was a process of adjustment that perhaps needed to go through on the part of the African tribes in adjusting to Western and white concepts of freedom and civil rights, whilst at the same time wanting to advance their own interests in the way that they had traditionally been brought up to, i.e. Conducting warfare against any rival tribes around them.
Yeah, I think they would have looked at it as, well, he doesn't own me, so why should we stay with him? And he's feeding us food and looking after us anyway, which is what he does for the slaves, but he doesn't own us, so why should we stay with him? And I think that would have been the mentality that these servants would have had, because they wouldn't have understood the idea of being paid wages for work or whatever. The whole system was that you were owned by somebody, and they took care of all your needs, and you took care of all their needs. And as you were pointing out there, Max, this warfare that they had, if they didn't take the other side as slaves, they would just massacre the other side. They would massacre them. In some cases, they would eat them as well. I mean, it was incredibly barbaric, really barbaric. I mean, when we were hearing about how the river was just filled with bodies and the paddle steamer couldn't turn its wheels for all the bodies of the slaves that were there. I mean, it's vile. I was reading about Henry Morton Stanley, and there was one of his retinue that actually paid one of these Africans to cook and eat his slave in front of him, because he wanted to study cannibalism, because these were cannibals that did this. I mean, it, just so barbaric, you know, you just can't really imagine quite how it was. And it was the British that put a stop to that. And if Britain hadn't set these colonies up, if Britain hadn't been colonizers, this African slave trade would have still been going on. It was the colonies that actually helped to put a stop to it. And it was the Africans that were most adamant that they wanted to continue with the slave trade. It was the British that said, no, you're not going to do this. It was the British that paid for the Navy to go all around the world stopping the slave traders. And it's an absolute scandal that today we've got all these institutions that are saying, well, we can't have this anymore because that was linked with slavery, when they should be saying, we are the only people in the entire history of the world that put a stop to this trade. And the very people that wanted to continue it were the people that are today blaming the British for it. I mean, if Africa had had a united system there, they could have just simply made it illegal, but they didn't. Well, after obtaining fresh supplies from Stanley, who afterwards left for England, Livingstone moved south again, obsessed by his quest for the Nile sources and his desire for the destruction of the slave trade, but his illness overcame him. In May 1873, at Chitambo, in what is now northern Zambia, Livingstone's African servants found him dead, kneeling by his bedside as if in prayer. His loyal attendants, Chuma and Susie, removed his heart and buried it under a tree near the spot where he died, which has been identified variously as a Mavula tree or a Baobab tree. That site, now known as the Livingstone Memorial, lists his date of death as the 4th of May, the date reported and carved into the tree's trunk by Chuma and Susie. But most sources consider the 1st of May, the date of Livingstone's final journal entry, as the actual correct one. In a difficult journey of 9 months, the rest of his remains were carried, together with his journal, over 1,000 miles, a journey that took 63 days by Chuma and Susie to the coastal town of Bagamoyo, where they were returned by ship to Britain for burial. In London, his body lay in repose at No. 1 Savile Row, then the headquarters of the Royal Geographical Society, prior to its interment at Westminster Abbey. I just want to point out, this is really good of his servants here, because they were there on their own. They had come out to find him, and they buried his heart there under the tree, which is what he wanted. And then they managed, and then they took his remains a thousand miles to the coast and made certain that he was able to get back to Britain. I mean, there must have been temptations there. I mean, they could have eaten him, but they didn't. They were fairly civilized, these two. So we have to give them credit there, I think.
And that would have been a very difficult thing to do, not just from the point of view of carrying the weight of a body for 1,000 miles, but also, as you can imagine, there would have been no refrigeration in those days. So that body would have been in an advanced state of decay by the time they got it to the coast to ship it to Britain, and it would have been a pretty stinking, horrible thing to carry, I would imagine.
That is a really good point there. I mean, that must have been really dreadful for them doing that. So we have to credit them. What do they we say their names were? Chuma and Susie. Yeah. Livingstone made geographical discoveries that vastly expanded European knowledge. And he inspired abolitionists of the slave trade, explorers, and missionaries. He opened up Central Africa to missionaries who initiated education and healthcare for Africans, as well as facilitated trade by the African Lakes Company. He was held in great esteem by many African chiefs and local people, and his name helped relations between them and the British. So he set a very good example, really, and helped it out, helped us out, basically, when we went back out there, because he had such a good reputation. He may well have influenced Western attitudes towards Africa more than any other individual before him. His discoveries, geographic, technical, medical, and social, provided a complex body of knowledge that is still being explored today. In spite of his paternalism and Victorian prejudices, Livingstone believed wholeheartedly in the African's ability to advance into the modern world. He was, in this sense, a forerunner for not only European imperialism in Africa, but also of African nationalism. And I think we can also look here at his individualism. He may not have been such a good leader of his teams, but as an individual, I mean, that drive to continue doing what he's doing, to stay out there on his own and still keep all his marbles and keep sane and keep working at recording everything in his journal. I mean, he's got some real courage there and strength of will. Within 50 years of his death, colonial rule was established on the continent and white settlement was encouraged to extend further into the interior. However, what Livingstone envisaged for colonies was not what we now know as colonial rule, but rather settlements of dedicated Christian Europeans who would live among the people to help them work out ways of living that did not involve slavery. Livingstone was part of an evangelical and non-conformist movement in Britain, which during the 19th century helped change the national mindset from the notion of a divine right to rule lesser races to more charitable ideas in foreign policy. And as was pointed out, it was actually this colonizing that helped to put a stop to the slavery. And what they're really saying here is that Livingstone understood he was a white man, and as white men, we are supposed to set a good example. And that's why he was saying he wanted Christian Europeans to live among the people so that they set them a good example, so they could see the way that the white man lived, see that it would be more beneficial for them to live in that way than the way that they were. And they had a good example that they could follow. And this was the way that white people thought back then. The slave owners in America thought in exactly the same way. They wanted to set a good example to these people. And they looked on them more like they were children than anything else. And they saw themselves as being adults, and they saw the black Africans as being children, which is would be a natural way to look at them. You've got a people that didn't develop writing, didn't put a sail on a boat, they didn't develop the wheel, they didn't develop a lot of things, and they were very very warlike, very savage-like. And if you could just give them the encouragement and show them a good example, then they would be very good people. And they would try to copy the white man, they would copy his rituals, they would get marriage. I mean, they didn't have really marriage in the same way that we had it, but they did in the slavery times, and they allowed them to have marriage ceremonies, and they encouraged them to live in the way that the white man did. And I think David Livingstone, his ideas were very similar here with what he was wanting to do in Africa as far as living among them. But it was through his mapping of the country and through his going up the rivers that made it possible for these colonies to be built, which actually led to the end of slavery. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just to say that, I think as far as Livingstone is concerned, his intentions were good, and as far as the Christian missionaries that he encouraged to go out to Africa is concerned, their intentions were good. I think that they were mistaken, though, in expecting that the Africans would want to live exactly as white people do. And I think that the continuing wars that we have seen in Africa, and particularly the massacres that took place between the Hutus and the Tutus, and the constant warring that there seems to be in the Horn of Africa around Somalia and the countries in that area, what they tend to indicate is that civilization isn't something that can be immediately transferred from one race of people to another. There may be individuals amongst both races who can practice civilization, but I think that to some extent the hopes of people like David Livingstone were naive, and that those hopes really have been shown to have not come to fruition in the way that they probably would have hoped.
I think he'd be very upset to see the state of the world today, and to see what Britain is like, and to see the clash that we have between the different races and the multiculturalism, and how it really hasn't worked out as a benefit to anyone, how it's much better to have people within their own ethnic groups. And I think you're right there that they have shown that they may not have wanted to be living in this way, because they now have a lot of poverty, they now have a lot of starvation, the wars that they have amongst one another have increased with all these weapons that we have brought them. It would have been better to have just left them be, to develop at their own race, at their own pace rather. You can't export civilization, basically. It has to be developed by a people in the way that it has been developed by Europeans. The David Livingstone Centre in Blantyre celebrates his life and is based in the house in which he was born, on the site of the mill in which he started his working life. And remember, he started from a very, very poor background, working 14 hours a day in a cotton mill, and managed to work his way up to exploring Africa. His Christian faith is evident in his journal, in which one entry reads, "I place no value on anything I have or may possess, except in relation to the kingdom of Christ. If anything will advance the interests of the kingdom, it shall be given away or kept, only as by giving or keeping it I shall promote the glory of him to whom I owe all my hopes in time and eternity." And he really seemed to have lived by that, giving away what he thought he should give away and keeping what he should keep. In 2002, David Livingstone was named among the 100 Greatest Britons following a UK-wide vote, and he somehow found the time to sire 6 children with his wife in between expeditions. That's incredible. You think she managed to make her way out to him, and that was actually how she died. But he still managed to have six children. Got any final thoughts on David Livingstone, Max?
Well, I think that what I said just a few moments ago kind of sums up. I think that he rightfully deserves a place as one of the 100 greatest Britons. I think that what he demonstrated was the good intentions of many people who were instrumental in creating the British Empire. But I think that his hopes with regard to exporting civilization were naive hopes, it's just a shame really that instead of just cranking back the export of civilization to a rate of export that could be assimilated by the African states, what's happened is that there's been a swing of the pendulum the other way, where there now is no attempt to export civilization to Africa on the basis that to do so is sort of paternalistic and therefore doesn't show respect to the African nations. That what we now see is that there is a continuation of the rivalry between various tribal groups, where the bloodshed is probably just as bad as it was back in Livingstone's days, in that it's bloodshed that's caused by automatic weapons, etc., that Western countries are sold to African countries. And so we shouldn't have allowed the pendulum to swing back as far as it has, in my view, if we really wanted Western standards of civilization to be permanently established in Africa.
I think what it also shows is the drive to actually go into Africa was born out of trying to improve the lives of the Africans, and the colonizing wasn't about trying to get cheap labor. It wasn't about trying to get slave labor or anything like that. It was about doing away with the slave labor, and it was about improving their lives and giving them another economy and encouraging them to make things and trade and to build and to get them to try and do things for themselves, really. And yet we're taught today that it's the complete opposite. And yet when you look at David Livingstone's life, you can see what the motives were. And you can say, and those were the motives of the British. They were noble ideals that they had. It wasn't about enslaving people and getting cheap labour. It was about improving their lives. Thank you very much for listening, and do watch out later in the year here at RadioAlbion.com for more in our series on our greatest Britons.